Hi, and welcome to the Voices of World Christianity podcast. My name is Noam.
And I'm Chow. Today we have Elizabeth Martin, and she graduated from University of Edinburgh just recently. Today we're going to be looking at basing our conversation off two of her articles that she has published, one on Exchange Journal, published by Brill, and the other one on the Journal of World Christianity of the Penn State University Press.
Thanks so much for joining us, Elizabeth. And firstly, congratulations. We're so excited that you're here as our esteemed doctor, because for the listeners, Dr. Elizabeth Martin has just passed her Viva. No corrections, no bragging, but we're so happy that you're here with us. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be on this podcast.
Great. So Elizabeth, could you tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and then maybe just start to tell us about your research?
I was a PhD candidate at the Centre for the Study of World Christianity, the University of Edinburgh, and I've been doing research on Palestinian Christianity, particularly from an ethnographic and a theological background. And I'm originally from the Netherlands.
That's great. Thanks so much. We were so fascinated to hear about your research on Palestinian Christianity. Could you tell us a little bit about what kind of inspired you to study this very interesting topic and your experiences with studying it? And I know that you spent some time in Palestine as well for your fieldwork. So yeah, please just talk us through about your experiences studying this context.
This study is actually the result of a longer engagement that actually goes back to the summer of 2013 when I was doing volunteering work in Bethlehem. And then it happened to be that I was staying with a Palestinian Christian guest family, and we had such a good conversations, and they stayed with me when I went to Edinburgh to do the Master in World Christianity. And there I also figured out that there were not so many classes on the Middle East. So I just started doing my own research, my own essays on Middle Eastern Christianity, Palestinian Christianity. And that from one thing turned into the other, and that actually became my doctorate. And I'm now so fascinated in it that I'd like to continue studying Palestinian Christianity. So it really started there with the people, with, you know, conversations with them.
That sounds great. Yeah. So Noam and I actually, we both do ethnography for our research. So we're a little, you know, we have a little bit of experience with it. Just curious, could you say something about the role of ethnography and fieldwork in world Christianity and or a Christian theology when doing Christian theology?
That's a good question. I think it is very exciting new development that is really growing. In both theology and in world Christianity. I think it started first in theology. So from the 2000 onwards, there was a group, especially in ecclesiology and practical theology and Christian ethics, that started to use ethnography as a means to ask and answer theological questions. And then it was not just something that they added to their repertoire, so it was not complementary, but they really embraced it as a way to ground their theological work in lived experience. And I think that's a very interesting conversation. So you have, for example, Mary McClintock Ferguson, who says God is mediated through the messy place that is the world. And I think that is very beautiful. And Christian Scharen and Anna-Marie Wiegen, who say theology is not simply a text about a text, but a reflection on the many forms of wisdom that are to be found in non-academic places. And so I studied both anthropology and theology. So these phrases really resonated with me. And then you have Peter Fenn in a more rural Christianity environment, who says theology in rural Christianity context has different resources and new methods. So he looks at people, language, art, woman, but also at other religions. So that is a new development that I'm very interested in. And you actually have way more. So I made a short list. You have, for example, Jeff Astley, who talks about ordinary theology. You have Kevin Van Hooser, who talks about everyday theology. And Martin Percy, implicit theology, and way more sociological theology, anthropological theology, grassroots theology, lived theology. So it really is, I think, you know, exponentially growing at the moment. And then in my research, so if I take the conversation back to Palestinian Christians again, so I was searching for theology among the people, particularly. It was quite difficult to find it at first, to be honest, because, you know, the University of Edinburgh is a Protestant place. So I was searching particularly to spoken words, you know, and written text. So I was looking beyond the written text, but I was still trying to find conversations, you know, words among the people. But then, I mean, they speak about their faith, but in a way more, you know, it's actually more embodied, it's more practiced. So I couldn't really get a lot of conversation out of the people. So I figured out that I had to look beyond the text and the spoken words. And I found it particularly when I was with people going to their shrine or on pilgrimage or after church, do it during church. Then there were conversations and there I had observations. So I found out that theology in a Middle Eastern context is implicit. That is non-textual, of course, and I think we talk about in a minute about the Palestinian theologians, but with the people, it was way more embodied. So I particularly found theology in social engagements and also in biblical associations and in ritual behavior. That is particularly where I found theology.
That's quite interesting. I wonder if you've encountered the subfield anthropology of Christianity during your studies, and if you could say a word on that.
Yeah, anthropology of Christianity, very interesting. They are also looking more to theology right now. So you can see that theology is now trying to engage more with ethnography, but anthropology is searching for new theological questions. So they're actually bridging the gap right now. And that's very interesting. Yeah.
That's so interesting what you were saying about how when you went to the field site, you kind of come to it with a certain idea of what you're looking for. And then, you know, you encounter that they're actually, you know, like you were saying, that the theology was more embodied. You're looking for a certain thing. I remember we were having a conversation before I went on field work. And that was one of kind of the advice that you gave me, or you were sharing your experiences of that. So I was wondering if you could say a bit more about, like, the fact is that, you know, fieldwork in world Christianity and using social scientific methods sounds great and sounds like, you know, this is the way we should be doing theology, lived reality, is all that kind of stuff, which I totally agree with. But then actually sometimes the reality is that it's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly hard to kind of have these conversations with people and try and connect with them and convince them that you're worth talking to. And I was wondering if you could share some of your experiences with about your difficulties in the field and how you navigated those.
Yeah, there's always a cultural bridge that you have to. Yeah, in the beginning, there was a lot of talk about family, and that was very interesting, of course, and you have to get to know people. And I really figured out that you have to take the time for yourself to get to know other people, but also other people have to get to know you. So you have to establish rapport, how they always say that. Mm. And so in the beginning of my fieldwork, I lived in a beautiful house, more in the border of the village. So I felt always a bit outside of the village. So when something was happening, I did not know about it, or I only heard it when it was already going on. And then after a couple of months, I figured out that I have to move really inside the village, in the center of the village. And then things started to open up. So people start to invite me into their houses. Mm-hmm. And then people start to get to know you. And they invited me to dinners and special family gatherings and Christmas and Easter. And that was really when things started to open up. And also when I started to realize how I should approach them. So I was particularly traveling around to different Christian feasts. So we're talking here about Orthodox and Catholic Christians mainly. So pilgrimage is huge. And of course, there in the Holy Land, you have lots of very interesting places and also places that we in the West don't know about. So St. George was a very big theme in my work. So there's a local shrine in Tibet, but there are many more shrines for St. George and the Virgin Mary and St. Elias, so that is the Prophet Elijah. And I figured out if going to these places, there I started to understand way more of their religiosity and their context. And that opened up new questions and new conversations. So it really was, I know Clifford Geertz has this idea of interpretist ethnography. So I remember when I was in my master or bachelor, so that my teacher drew an onion on the whiteboard. So every time you have to peel off a different layer. And that really was a good metaphor for me, because that really was my field work. I started out with a good idea of what the onion was, but I had to really every time peel off different layers. And then cannot say that I really reached the core. I think that is a bit essentialist, but I started to peel off many layers. And I think that is one of the points of ethnographic theology or theological ethnography, is that your view of theology becomes way more nuanced.
Mm.
So a written text, theology, in the beginning, I sometimes felt like there was a gap between what I read of Palestinian theologians like Mitri Rahem, Naim Matik, but also Michel Saba and Johanna Catenaccio, Munter Isaac. I thought there was a gap also because the people in the village of Taibe, where I did my fieldwork, they didn't know those names. They did know Michel Saba, of course. He was a patriarch of the Latin Patriarchates, so a Roman Catholic. And he's a very known figure. So, of course, they know them. But those theologians who mainly write books, and they are Protestants, so they are a bit outside of their world. Mitri Rahab, Naim Matik, I'm talking about right now. They just didn't know them. So I was thinking, okay, I have this idea of theology, but what next? But then I figured out that their themes are actually not different, but it's just a very different way of expressing. And those layers of the onion are coming off. And then I started to see that theology of the books and theology of the people is not a different thing. It is not a different thing at all. It is about the same themes. It is liberation theology of Naim Matik. I also found liberation among the people, especially with St. George. St. George is a strong fighter. He was especially talked about in times of trouble, and then they call on him and they see him as an indigenous saint from the region, and St. George is there for them to protect them. So he is a liberator, and especially his story of martyrdom and his beheading and his way of standing up for the Christian faith is very much an inspiration for the Palestinian people to keep on going and also to stand up for themselves and to speak out for themselves. So it is not a liberation theology as we know about as academics, but it is about the same themes. It is about liberating from oppression. So that was very interesting to see. And that takes months of fieldwork.
Thank you. Elizabeth, in your opinion, what's the importance of studying these grassroots theology or, you know, these lives of religion? And during that process of studying this, what could you tell us something that maybe surprised you, revealed something? And you briefly mentioned already about, you know, comparing with the theologians, but maybe revealed what written texts and institutions don't talk about, they tend to ignore.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I don't think that people in the Christian leaders are ignoring lived religiosity. It is just a different way of approaching. And so one of the examples where I saw this very clearly is the Biblical Association in Taibe. So let me explain that a bit. So Taibe is a small village. You have big cities like Jerusalem, Nazareth, and Bethlehem that we know from the Bible, and important biblical events happen there. But Taibe is not so well known. But the people of Taibe, they consider their village going back to the village of Ephraim from the New Testament and Ophrah from the Old Testament. So they also say that their village has biblical significance. So I saw here a parallel with the Living Stones theology, which is used by the Christian leaders very much. It is very emphasized. So Living Stones means that they are connecting Palestinian Christians to notions of an ancient lineage between contemporary Palestinian Christians and the first Christians from apostolic times. And this is usually mentioned in the context of their, you know, their worth and why they should be there, their historical belonging, their territorial legitimacy, but also their hopes for the future. So they belong here in the land. And you should also see that in connection to more Zionist biblical interpretations, where they said that the Jews belong to the land. And then they say, yes, but we belong to the land as well. And this was it was one of those surprises for me that I saw. So you have this Living Stones theology of the church leaders, but you have this biblical association in the village. But actually, it is the same. Actually, they're trying to say the same things. They're trying to say, we are here for a long time and we belong here and we should not be driven out. So that was one of those surprises from ethnography.
That's really interesting. Same, but any difference between the two? I mean, I'm sure because they're coming from, you know, it made me talk a little bit about, what did you think?
So I think it's mainly in, you know, theology is a specialization. It takes years to study it. So biblical hermeneutics, you read the text in the ancient languages. Hermeneutics, we have specialized words such as God promises, the covenants, and those Palestinian Christians, they use them. They also have been studying in the West. And people in the village may not always use universalization of the land or the covenants. So I think it is in those technicalities that you see the differences, but the themes, they are the same. And the hopes, they are the same.
That's really interesting, Elizabeth. I was wondering do you feel like the Palestinian people on the ground felt that these theological scholars spoke for them, or was it very much of a case of like theological scholars do one thing and then the Palestinians do the other, and generally they're aiming for the same theme of liberation, references to land, etc., but they're very much distinct or separate projects, or was it more like intertwined?
I think it's more intertwined. So we have different Palestinian theologians. So Naim Atik, Mitri Raheb, who are mainly known in the West, they are Protestants. So they are, of course, known in their own congregations. But the village where I did my fieldwork were mainly Orthodox and Catholic. So Michel Saba was a church leader and Catholic church leader, and he was very well known. And for example, during Christmas, the Christmas celebration, then the Feast of the Latins in Jerusalem is always aired on television. And that's a moment when people, you know, they have their nice dinners, they already went to their churches in their own villages, and then they switch on the television, and then they listen to what Patriarch Michel Saba said, or what the current patriarch is saying, who is an Italian, but he still speaks for the Palestinians. But so, and Michel Saba was also political in his sermons and really tried to say something, not only in a spiritual way, but also in a, you know, for the Palestinian people. So I think they always, that really is, you know, the same community, and they feel that their church leaders speak for them. But those Protestants are maybe outside their community, and their books are mainly written for a Western public, so to advocate the Palestinian cause. So they don't know about them, but it is in the end it's the same themes that Michel Saba is also speaking about. So it's just different audiences, but I wouldn't say those are two different projects.
That's really interesting. It's good to hear the interplay between the two. And if I could just ask you a question as a fellow researcher, I think this is something that I will have to, you know, wrestle with in my own work, is the question of what weight do we give to either group. So for me, I'm looking at Asian feminist theologians, and the majority of them are speaking to a Western audience or just speaking to a diasporic audience. They're trained in elite institutions, etc., etc., but then at the same time also doing interviews with migrant women. So I guess the question that I'll have to eventually answer in my thesis is like, what weighting do I place on either group if they're both kind of speaking from the same perspective? So as a researcher, I was wondering if you could talk me through about your experiences of putting that together in your thesis, putting that together in your research.
Yeah, so I studied both. So in my thesis, I take the reader then through Palestinian theology, and I try to explain how it emerges. But then in the next section, I found parallels in the village, so that a village is also becoming more outspoken. So I give that the name, the new phase of Palestinian Christianity, or reinvention. So I saw two processes happening, reinvention and a renewal. So I speak about a reinvention, which has happened in both theology, but also in the people. And that's how I try to balance the two. So my emphasis is mainly on what's happening on the ground. So what's happening beyond the written text, beyond the religious institutions. But they are part of the same community, you know, it is a unity. So I try to balance it, and I try to give way to both. But then, you know, intertwine it in my thesis. So then I take you to theologians, and then I take you to what's happening on the ground. And I very much see that there, in the end, is a unity. Mm. Beginning, I thought, how am I going to do this? There's a gap. But more and more, I start to see overlaps. And during the thesis, during the writing and the thinking, you know, all the dots became connected. And that's how I try to wrote it down in my thesis.
Mm. That's a really interesting kind of reminder that, like, theologians even are still living within the context in which you're speaking about. And even though we might think they're, you know, in their ivory tower of academia, they, you know, like the rest of us, are still engaged in the world and thinking about the world.
Yeah. And they have families and, mm-hmm. you know, they have villages where they come from. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Also, I loved your Aviva answer. That felt very much like this is something that she's kind of prepared and thought about. But that was excellent. Chao, you had a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, Elizabeth, you mentioned a couple times already, you know, Catholics and Protestants. And in your paper, you had written about Orthodox. I wonder if you could paint a picture of the Christian community in the land. Is it what kind of denominations are there? And do these do they engage in ecumenism and that kind of?
Yeah, sure. So Palestinian Christian community is very diverse. Most of the Palestinian Christians are part of the Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox Church. But from the 19th century, missionaries came, and then first the Latins and the Greek Melkites. So you have also a big proportion of the community who is Catholic. So I'd say about one third is Orthodox and then one third is Catholic, but you do have different Catholics. So in the West Bank, they talk about the Latins, which is more from Rome, to say so, a Latinized Roman Catholic Church. But, you know, that started as a Latinized church, but it has been indigenized. That started out with mainly European church leaders, but the Palestinians now are also trained as priests. So it's very much a Palestinian church right now. It didn't start that way, but it has been indigenized. And then you have the Greek Catholics, which are a very interesting community. So that's one of those unionated churches. So that is a bit between Orthodox and Catholic. So they look like Orthodox, but they do follow the Pope. It is a long history of a schism in 1724, if I'm not mistaken, that a group in Syria wanted to follow the Pope, but wanted to remain Orthodox. And it was a fight, but then in the end, they became part of the Roman Catholic Church, and then it spread throughout the Middle East. And now it very much is an Arab church, so they portray themselves as the Arab church. They're also very politically outspoken. And then you do have smaller churches, the Protestants, you have Anglicans, you have Latins, you do have a small Church of Scotland, you do have Evangelicals, but there are also a small community of Copts, of Maronites, especially in Jerusalem and Syriacs. But I'd say the biggest are the Greek Orthodox and the Catholics. Oh, and then, sorry, I just remember the question, if they are together ecumenical. Yeah, that's an interesting question. So on the ground, actually, at the moment, it's quite ecumenical. People marry with Christians from other churches, and that happens quite easily. But the church leaders are sometimes quite protective of their community, of their churches. And that also has to do because of this, the Holy Land. So churches, they have property, Orthodox, Catholics, they do have their pilgrimage sites. And so in the Church of the Nativity and the Church of the Sepulchre, that are two most important churches in the Holy Land, and maybe, you know, from Christianity worldwide, where Jesus has been born and where Jesus has been crucified and buried. So there, those churches have different parts. So the Armenians, they have a part, and the Orthodox have a part, and the Franciscans from the Roman Catholic Church, they are the custodians of the Holy Land. They have their part. So sometimes, you know, you see an Orthodox prayer going on, and then you have to wait a while, and then the Latin starts. And there have been moments when there were literal fights that have going on in the church, and especially around Easter, when it's so important, and also Christmas, then they have arrangement at that time. Then the Orthodox have their liturgies, and that time then the Catholics. And then you always see also if I went to a Catholic procession in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but then the Armenians were also present and the Orthodox were also present to protect their, you know, their property and to protect their place in this such an important church. So on that level, you see quite some rivalry, but on the grounds, yeah, no, their people are ecumenical and it goes very well.
That's really interesting what you're saying about on the ground people are, you know, intermarrying from denominations and stuff like that. It feels like a recurring theme in our conversation is, you know, the what we might perceive to be happening versus what people are actually living through.
Yes, yes.
Let's move on to my question, the one that you said you were slightly worried about. Sorry to throw in. I'll give you some context for this. So I was reading the articles that Chao mentioned earlier, and in it you kind of argue that the Palestinian contextual theology is socially and politically committed, and I don't think that's an unfair statement. I think many people agree with you. But my question was about whether or not there was an eschatological dimension to it. And the reason I asked is because one of the interviews that I did for my research, the woman was talking about how she'd experienced racism in the country that she had migrated to. And I asked her, what helped you deal with this racism? And she was like, I just know that in heaven, I will not have to deal with this, that I, you know, that God loves me and that in heaven there, things will be better. And that was what kind of gave her hope in dealing with the loneliness that she faced, the racism and hostility that she faced. And I wondered whether or not the Palestinian people that you talked to, that you lived among, was there an eschatological dimension to the ways in which they kind of sought to alleviate or comfort their pain and suffering?
Yeah, this is actually a great question. So in my conversations with the people, there was really not so much of an eschatological dimension. There was not much talk about a future in heaven. But when I think about it, so I do think so that the history of the Palestinians, there have been moments of hope, but every time it has been scattered. And at the moment, it really does seem like the situation for Palestinian Christians is hopeless. What will the future bring? So then when there's an opportunity at the moment, you will seize it. So Christians have been, so a bit of history. So they have long been living in the Middle East, of course, and they do really feel like part of the area. And there has been a moment in the 19th and 20th century, what is called the Nahda, that's a renaissance cultural movement, that Christians really start to contribute even more in the sphere of education, literature, nationalist thoughts. And you still see that at the moment in theology, but also in healthcare and in education, they really try to make a good contribution to the society. So in a way, that is, of course, a way how they deal with all the insecurities that's happening in their context. So in a way, it is seizing the opportunity that is presented to you today, because you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. So in a way, it is having connections to your fellow Muslim neighbors and being part of them and being in unity, because they do have a political, you know, enemy in Israel. That's how they feel it. So being together with the Muslims, being part of society, is in a way bringing hope for tomorrow. And then theologically speaking, there very much is a strong conviction that God is on their side. So here, this is a very interesting conversation, theological conversation with Zionism, that, you know, the Jews are the chosen people, so God takes care of them. And then, but the Palestinians say, yeah, but God is there for all of us. God is a universalist God. God is not a selective God, only for the Jews. So in a way, it is it is eschatological. It is a hope for the future that God is at their side. But it was not talked about. It was not really... So theologians do speak about a hope, and people speak about a hope. But yeah, I'm not really sure if I can make that conclusion, because I did not really have observations about it. But if you think about it, if you think it true, it is a way of giving meaning to their suffering.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And it's this kind of idea that, like, you know, some people do criticize, maybe not criticize, but one of the kind of limitations almost of a kind of eschatological hope is that some people might say that it focuses your attention on the not yet instead of working to change the now. And it seems like the Palestinian people that you were talking to were kind of more focused on working to change the now.
Yeah, I think that's a good conclusion. Yes.
Mm, yeah.
Heaven is also here on earth. It's also sometimes what they say in these conversations.
That's really interesting. So did they have an idea of what heaven would look like for them? Would it in these conversations or?
Yeah, I don't really know. I'm sorry. That was not really part of our conversations.
That's fair enough. That's fine. Just thought I'd ask, yeah.
Elizabeth, you wrote about the context of co-resistance mm-hmm. and the context of coexistence amongst mm-hmm. the Palestinian Christians in their relationship with their Jewish and Muslim neighbors, right? In your estimation, which one of these contexts was more dominant in your field?
Yeah, I'd say so. That is a different conclusion that I took more for Israel and Palestine. Israel, yes, together, but my research has really been focusing on the West Bank. And there in the West Bank, you see Christians being more together with the Muslims. So that probably is more of a co-resistance context, where in Israel, you also have groups who try to have conversations with, you know, the whole society. And that's more of a coexistence. I think in the end, Palestinian Christians are peaceful people. So in that way, it's a coexistence story, but they're also very much Palestinian in the way that they want to have their own state. So that's a co-resistance. I cannot really say which context is more. I think there it's more of a theological emphasis that I saw with the different Palestinian theologians. So some are really going for a reconciliation and narrative, but others say, like Maimatik, first we have to have justice. And peace, and then we can talk about reconciliation.
So for these two scenarios, particularly interesting the coexistence situation. And I was wondering for our listeners, what might be some of the unique insights from that coexistence context that we might be able to take away that might be helpful for us.
So yeah, so coexistence is what I observed among a group of evangelical theologians, especially. So there's a group that's called Musalaha that really is going for reconciliation and that tries to have conversations with Jews, especially with Messianic Jews, that through their shared Christianity, they have something in common, even though if they're politically different, coming from two sides, being Palestinian and being Jewish. That even though being Christian, you still have something in common, and that could be a conversation. And from there, new conversations can happen, and you can work towards peace. So maybe that could be a lesson that as Christians, we can be different. We can have different political opinions, but in the end, we are still brothers and sisters in Christ. And if we start there, then we can try to overcome our differences and work towards unity and peace.
I really love that. Thank you. That's beautiful.
That's really, really interesting. The idea that, you know, something that I've kind of always thought about in a context like this is the Christian impetus to forgive and mm-hmm. to, as you said, to be brothers and sisters in Christ. But then at the same time, how do you practice forgiveness in a context that's so incredibly difficult? And that you've suffered a lot. So I'm kind of been thinking about this context I've been thinking about these questions in the context of racial justice and the idea that like I, you know, have a right to exist as a human being, as a brown human being, and I live in a system that has disadvantaged me in a lot of ways because of my skin color, but then and I've had people be quite hurtful to me because of my skin color. But then at the same time, as a Christian, I do feel the godly, you know, God commands me to forgive. And I wondered, you know, in the context of the Palestinian Christians that you were living and working among, so was there any kind of sense of wrestling with this tension between forgiveness, but then also wanting justice and wanting to fight for them, for their rights? Was that something that they kind of talked about or not?
Yeah, very much so. And I now particularly think about the theologians. So it's interesting. So what I just said, Naim Atik, he has this sense of we cannot really forgive people if they don't do justice to us. So first we want to see them acknowledging us, and then we are also acknowledging them. We acknowledge them. So it's really a two-way street. So first we want to see justice, and then we can reach peace, and only then we can reach reconciliation. And those are not steps that we have to forget just in order to have reconciliation. We also want to see them acknowledging us. And I think that's the sentiment that I observed among the Palestinian people in general. You know, they have been hurted a lot in the past, not only by the Jewish neighbors, not only by oppression, but also by Western Christians and Western people in general, who have forgotten about them and who have very, you know, without thinking, chosen the side of the Jews, because of theological opinions, because of historical developments. But they also should be acknowledged. And that's very much, I think they're also in a way, they are a proud people. They want to be acknowledged. They see their own worth. And I think that's very important. I think that's a good lesson to take from Palestinians. They believe in their own worth.
That's excellent. That's really, really encouraging to hear. I think we're about coming to the end of our time, but Elizabeth, was there anything else that you wanted to share about your research or about your, you know, findings that, before we close up?
Yeah, maybe it's interesting to say. So I think Palestinian Christians are usually portrayed as victims or very passive, that things happen to them. But what I very much saw in my PhD, that they are active, that they are taking matters into their own hands. So I use the words reinvention and renewal. So they reinvented themselves as socially and political contributors to society. We talked already about that during this podcast. But they also renewed their own religious, the way how they express religion. So scripture, we talked about that. The way how they use the biblical narrative in order for them to express their belonging to the land, but also St. George veneration, which is not just spiritual anymore, but also a way of thinking about liberation and belonging and martyrdom. And so I like to end this by saying the Palestinian Christians are really active and really agents in history, and that they are very much very creative in their theologies and very strong people. And they are not passive, like usually what we talk about in the West, that Christianity is disappearing from the region. And maybe the numbers are not looking good, but they are really strong people who are really trying to make the best out of the situation. So I'd like to really end this podcast on a positive note by saying this.
100%. Yeah. And I think that's something that kind of has been a central theme throughout our conversation, is this idea of like what we might think of as one thing, the reality on the ground looks very different. And I mean, we haven't really talked about the St. George veneration too much, but your article was so fascinating because it kind of made me think what might look like a typical, you know, saint veneration practice is actually so much more, because they're reading St. George as a liberator, as a martyr, et cetera, et cetera. And it kind of helps you reconfigure or plays with your idea of what resistance looks like or what agency looks like. And then, you know, the Palestinian people on the ground are doing something very different, which we might not think of as resistance, but it is, because of the, you know, we just need to change the way we're thinking about it.
Yeah, and they're a small community, but they are powerful. They're, I think, way more powerful than we would think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. You really, your research and your responses, your talk in this podcast really imbues the essence of the World Christianity Study, right? The study of World Christianity, yes. The field, right? So thank you so much for shedding so much light on this important group of Christians living in Palestine. Thank you for your research and your work. And we hope you do great work in the future, no matter where you go. Thank you for coming to speak with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for our conversation, Elizabeth.
Yeah, so that will close our podcast for this time. And so we thank you for listening. Really looking forward to future conversations. We've got some really interesting ones lined up. And so thank you for listening. Have a great day. Stay safe and talk to you later. Bye.